Fearscape Media Network, exploring the unknown, one podcast at a time.
Ladies and gentlemen, to the penultimate season 4 episode of The Convergence Enigma with Josh and Stefan. I am your host, Stefan Gearhart, joined as always by the man with no chin, Josh Rutledge.
I think I have an extra chin, actually.
See, I was trying to give you a compliment.
Although my extra chin is getting smaller, I've lost
some weight. Stop flipping it around. It's kind of like silly putty. I'm like, I want to put some newspaper against it.
Well, I'm just, and it's my rooster. It's my little, whatever it's called down there. The thing.
I don't know what it's called.
Giblet? No. Giblet?
I can do SpongeBob with mine.
Yeah, we're going to get sued now.
Anyways, like we said, this is our second last episode of season 4. What an amazing season this has been, man. Like, I just got to say, it's been
we started the season with the change up of the name, going from Fearscape Paranormal to The Convergence Enigma. We've got on the UnX Network, but doing awesome stuff on there. If you're not listening to us or the other great shows on the UnX Network, make sure you check it out. You talk about the end of it being the end of season 4, and
not only that, cut you off. Like, we've moved to YouTube.
Yeah, well, we've always been on.
But I mean, actual video footage shows, right, with our interviews and with us. Yeah. It's awesome, man.
Yep. So even this one, where there isn't a guest, it's just our two smiling faces.
R2-D2.
You still get to see us in the backgrounds that we happen to pick for the random shows that we do. So,
yep. So, Josh, speaking of backgrounds, give them a little heads up about what today's episode is going to be up before we talk about what's going on next season.
Yeah. So this episode today, we're going to be talking about the Varginha, Brazil case. I said it right.
Not Virginia. That's in America. Virginia.
No, it's Varginha. And I actually looked up, and there is some correlation, I think, between Virginia in the U.S. and Varginha in the Brazil. Mainly in, like, the terminology. Like, it's not a person's name. It means something in a language. Yeah. Anyways.
The land of the virgins, I thought.
Yeah, that's... I don't know if that's the case. But anyways... in either case, U.S. or Brazil. So, this is a pretty big case. James Fox just recently released, his new documentary is covering the case. So we'll talk a little bit about that documentary in the show today and some kind of ancillary things that, our big thing, right, is our show is we're looking at how are these things related. And when I saw the documentary at UFO Congress for the first time, and then my own research into the case, there are a lot of corollaries with some other cases that we've talked about on the show. So we'll get into some of that too.
I'm excited, man. So of course, this is our penultimate show. We've got one more after this. We've got our season finale coming up in 2 weeks with Dr. Lynn Kitai, who I've been waiting to speak to for a very long time. I'm just super pumped. She is the expert on all things Phoenix Lights.
Phoenix Lights, right. I mean, and she's really the one that's kept it alive, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, a lot, So it'll be really good to talk with her. You know, she has her big event that happens every single year. Though they continue to add new evidence and new interviews and things to it. So yeah, it'll be
to the
fantastic.
documentary. Yeah, I got to go to it this year, the 25th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights, and I got to watch her documentary in a movie theater. Got to see the Paranormal Ranger guys for the first time, which who we just got to meet as well while we were out at our MUFON field investigator boot camp that we did a few weeks ago. That was a lot of fun. Yeah, the Paranormal Ranger guys that are on that episode of Unsolved Mysteries, they taught most of the stuff going on that whole weekend. And of course, our friend Mark D'Antonio as well was there teaching. So,
yeah, I mean, I was, you know, as somebody who grew up Southern Baptist and going to a lot of church camps that typically happen at church, I was disappointed to find that the boot camp did not involve a lot of boots. So,
I thought you were going to start talking about Vacation Bible School.
no.
No, but you know, one thing I liked about, and we'll get talking about what's happening next season in a second, but one thing I loved about the Paranormal Rangers episode on Unsolved Mysteries and what they talked about is that he said, you know, a lot of people ask us, do you believe in Bigfoot? Do you believe in UFOs? And he said, believe is the wrong word. Believe is something you do. It's faith-based. Believe is something you do when you don't have any evidence.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa.
Well, that's like, you know, we've talked about it before, even, you know, there it's no longer really the question even of if you believe in UFOs. It's UFOs are a fact. I mean, governments around the world, right, have said UFOs are a fact. The question now really becomes what are they and why are they here?
Yeah,
And
what are
that's
they?
where I think the more faith type stuff comes in, because, you know, there are people that think that, you know, they're illusions, they're people that think they're holograms, or people that think they're aliens. I mean, it could be any number of things. And I think that's where the belief part comes in. But you're right. I mean, when it comes to things like Bigfoot and UFOs and poltergeist, there is documented scientific evidence that support these things. So it's no longer a belief in those things. It's more of a, what is the nature of them, right?
Yeah, what are they?
Right.
Yep.
Why are they here?
Speaking of why are they here, like I said, next in 2 weeks we've got our season 4 finale, Dr. Lin Katai. You guys know that we always take off around December. We're going to be taking an extended break this time because when we come back for season five, Josh, when we come back for season 5, we are coming back with something amazing. Now, in the meantime, I'm going to tell you, this is going to be a couple months now because we're retooling. In the meantime, you may get some bonus episodes. I think we're going to re-release the "Twas the Night Before Cryptidmas" with JD. That'll get re-released. You know, maybe a couple archived episodes here or there, just to, you know, keep you hasting for more. But we're retooling next season. You want to share a little bit about what we're doing next season?
Yeah, you know, when we rebranded as the Convergence Enigma, it was the idea that the concept that these all of these different things, that parts of the phenomena, right? The UFO, Bigfoot, poltergeist, magical workings, etc., that they all kind of tend to congregate or converge in a given location. And so that's, you know, we rebranded that way. That's what next season is going to be. It's going to be a deep analysis into a location, looking at these convergences that happen in that location. So it's looking at all of the different type of phenomena, pulling it together to really kind of really provide evidence for the theory that these convergences happen. And the first one we're doing, right? The first one, if you want to tease a little bit, Stefan is in the Appalachians.
Yeah, so next season is going to be titled Dark Appalachia, so or Dark Appalachia, depending on who you're talking to. But we're going to be looking into Eastern Kentucky, West Virginia, Virginia, even up to the Hudson Valley. What's up with the Appalachian area? What's going on? Why are there so many convergences? Expect interviews, research. You're going to see just all kinds of stuff. We are changing
It's,
some things up. It's
yeah.
going to be one giant topic for the whole season. And it's going to be absolutely phenomenal. We're going to cover Mothman. We're going to cover the Flatwoods Monster. We're going to cover Indrid Cold. We're going to cover everything with deep dives. And hopefully, we're going to get some interviews with some people that were actually there and go from there. And we're going to be researching. And the cool thing about next season is that we hope that you become part of this research with us by joining our new Patreon.
Yep. So patreon.com/TC Enigma. That mirrors all of our social media accounts. So that's how you can find us on social media. So that's actually, it's the C Enigma, pardon me. So the C Enigma, and you can get on there and basically join the research. So we're going to use that as a methodology to post research topics that we're digging into at the moment, building up for the evidence for next season, as well as just, you know, hey, we're trying to find information about X number of thing or X person or whatever. And this is a way for you to get in on the investigation with us. And it's not, there's two different tiers. One just kind of like shows your support. One actually gets you into the discussion and conversation. So yeah, we'd love
it. We'll be discussing. Join. And we're calling it the Provenience Obscura Society. So join the society with us. Get in there. Help us research. Help us find people. Help us find clues. We want you guys as part of this as much as anything, because throughout the years, you guys have always reached out to us, sent us your stories, sent us your leads, sent us your people, sent us your research. And all of that has led us to where we are now, which is the Convergence Enigma. And so we want you to take a more active place here while helping us, you know, put together a little cash to help us get out there a little bit more and reach out to the people and do the things we need to do. So join the Provenience Obscura Society today. That's patreon.com/TheC Enigma. So get on there, and we'll be probably starting into that January, February. We're going to start really starting to hit on that after we take our break.
Yep. So. Got a break for the holidays. Got to burn a Yule log.
We got to get ready for Cryptidmas. So JD can check things out. But yeah, so anyways, season 5, The Convergence Enigma, Dark Appalachia. It's going to be exciting, man. I'm just telling you. You're going to see some old faces and some new faces, and it's going to be phenomenal, man. But Josh, before we get into talking about Varginia, I actually have some spooky news that I wanted to go over, because this, like, I got sent this by 2 or 3 different people, and it's just a good creepy one we haven't had in a while. So this comes from all over the place, of course, but the one I'm pulling from is from The Star over in the UK. And the headline reads, "Creepy black-eyed child ghost plagued UK village so much that a ghostbuster was called in."
Yeah, man.
So a paranormal investigator was called to a beauty spot in Staffordshire after receiving reports that a creepy black-eyed child had returned 30 years after her ghost was first spotted. Lee Brickley, 35, who is the author of Ghosts of Cannock Chase, Terrifying Reports of Paranormal Activity from the UK's Most Haunted Town. Ooh, that's a long title there, Mr. Brickley. Started scouring through the area in 2014 after receiving a report by a man that he and his wife encountered a girl whose eyes had no color. The man's sighting was shared with Huffington Post UK. Said, "Once we had entered the woodland and the road was no longer visible, we started to hear the giggling noise of a little girl." Josh, I'm out of there. I'm gone.
Yeah.
I'm gone. I'm gone already. But anyways, they continued on to say, "To our amazement, a child no taller than 1 meter in height appeared as if out of nowhere further up the path in front of us. We stopped dead in our tracks after noticing her eyes had no color. Her head was tilted to the side in much the same way it would appear as if she had been hung. She stared at us for around 5 minutes before running away into the densely grouped area of the trees. My wife wanted to follow her, but I was having none of it."
Yeah. That's how you end up dead, by the way.
Yeah. My wife would say, "Yeah, let's go." So neither of us would be going after this. And I would trip you so that you could get in on it and tell me about it later.
Right.
The woman contacted Brickley after claiming to have encountered the eerie sight. The terrified woman said, "Around 2 months ago, my daughter and I were walking through Birch's Valley, an area known for its spectral sightings, when we heard the screams of a young child." So this is another woman. "I couldn't tell if it was a boy or a girl, but they definitely seemed in distress and sounded very close to us. So we instantly started running towards the noise." British people, what is going on? John Matthews, can you tell me, is this a normal British thing?
I think it's just a normal human reaction. You hear a child screaming, you want to go help. I mean, that's...
Oh, okay. That makes more sense. I feel better about that.
Okay.
She continues on. She says, we couldn't find the child anywhere, so we stopped to catch our breath. That's when I turned around and I saw the girl standing behind me, no more than 10 years old, with her hands over her eyes like she was waiting for a birthday cake. Surprise! I asked if she was okay and if she had been the one screaming. She then put her arms down by her side and opened her eyes, which is when I saw that they were completely black. No iris, no white, nothing. I jumped back, I grabbed my daughter, and when I looked again, the child was gone. It was strange, really. I knew something was going to happen even before it did. I just had a weird feeling. So Brickley told the HuffPost UK that, in his opinion, the black-eyed child seems to be some sort of demon. While it might seem like the standard spectral encounter, almost all the reports involve the child leading people towards some sort of potentially dangerous situation. I've received 9 different reports in the last 2 years from seemingly credible witnesses. During interviews, most of the stories have all been very similar. The 35-year-old author also spoke of his own aunt's encounter with a black-eyed child back in 1982 when she was just 18 years old. He described the encounter on a blog post on his website. He said, she stumbled upon a dirt track and caught sight of the 6 to 8-year-old girl running in the opposite direction, shouting, help, mummy, help. By now, it was getting dark, and the little girl had reached an area of very densely planted, thick and bushy trees. She turned around to face my auntie, looked her dead in the eyes, and then ran off into the dark, compact woodland. At this point, probably very wisely, the decision was made to give up. The paranormal investigator added, in my mind, it seems likely that even if my auntie had continued to chase the little girl, she never would have caught her, because it wasn't a child at all, but an evil force planning to do away with one of my own family members. So,
you may not know this, but this ties in to our Dark Appalachia convergence that we're going to talk about next season.
Black-eyed children show up?
Well, so, in recent years, the geological societies of the world have come to an agreement that the Appalachian Mountains extends all the way into Norway and Sweden. You know, because it's the oldest mountain range in the world.
Yeah.
And it goes back to a time when all the continents were connected, you know, Pangaea and everything. Mm-hmm. And then as we spread apart, the mountain range has broken up and now occupies a couple of different areas of the world. But the area that you're talking about is near a section of the Appalachian Mountains. And you may recall in the show Hellier, as well as other accounts, that people in the West Virginia and Kentucky area of the Appalachians do talk about hearing children screaming in the mountains, and kind of like a baby crying, almost like they're being called into the area. There's a lot of disappearance cases that involves that. So in a roundabout way, you have talked about a case tonight that is related to what we're going to talk about next.
Oh, man. You know, that makes me want to re-release our Black-Eyed Children episode in the meantime. Maybe we'll do that. Maybe that's be one of the ones we re-release over the next couple months.
So, yeah, it's just really interesting how, again, the cosmos, or whatever you want to say, the fate, if you will, has kind of intervened here, and you've covered a story that is related to what we're going to talk about next season.
Cool.
So if that doesn't wet your whistle and entice you to come back, then, you know, well,
yeah, just be careful. If you live near Staffordshire, look out for the little girl, man. She gonna get you. Don't follow her in the woods. That's all I'm saying, mate.
The girl is gonna get you. The girl is gonna get you.
Oh, here she comes. You. She's a man eater. Literally, she will eat.
Literally. Yeah. It's probably a skinwalker, is probably what it is.
All right, Josh, now that we are 17 minutes in, let's dive right into it. Because I know people love that.
Yeah.
But no, let's get talking about our case that we're talking about for our second to last episode.
Maybe. Yeah. Virginia.
Brazil. Virginia.
So for those that are on YouTube, that are watching the show on YouTube, I will be throughout the show, you'll be able to see some pictures and things from the case if you're on the YouTube version. But also there's in my background, In Virginia is the monument that they built to the case, because they were just so so many people were witness to it and were involved in it. So anyways, if you haven't figured it out, that's your cue to now go to YouTube and watch the episode. So all right, the Virginia Brazil case. By the way, I love saying Virginia. In fact, I'm going to start calling Virginia U.S. Virginia, just because it's fun to say.
Yeah, and I was just looking. Move your head for a second. Let me see that picture. Yeah, so I was just looking it up, too. Did you know that that's a water tower?
I did.
Yeah. That's crazy cool. They made a UFO into a water tower.
Yeah, so it's not just a monument, right? Yeah. It's functional, so it's not just, you know, it doesn't just take up space. So, yep. So, anyways, January 1996. This is, of course, just what 16 months before
Phoenix Lights.
Yeah. Right.
So, Hale-Bopp.
In Hale-Bopp. This is an actual case that involves alien humanoids that were seen and touched by a number of people. The government swooped in, carried them away, never to be seen again. I mean, that's the synopsis, but we're going to dive into the details. So, NORAD, okay, which is the North American Radar something, aerial defense, something like that. I don't know. Somebody who's listening can comment and say, you're dumb, you don't know what NORAD stands for. Anyways, all I know is they track Santa Claus every year.
Amen.
But they had reported to the Brazilian government that they were tracking UFOs over their airspace in January 1996. A fisherman off the coast of Brazil actually saw some UFOs kind of maneuvering above the water and near the water and then flying over land. So there's sightings. Okay. Then you've got a guy, who was driving along and sees this UFO come up over his automobile and then crash. And he's the sole witness. Okay. He was the sole witness that saw the UFO crash. And he gave a video testimony at the time about what he saw, and then he disappeared.
Oh, classic. So it's not just the United States, huh?
Yeah. So what he talked about, what he saw, though, was this craft coming over. He said it kind of maneuvered like it was sluggish, they were fighting, in his words, they were fighting to keep control. It kind of like flew over to an area a little bit to his left, and then it kind of pulled back around to his right, and then ultimately crashed into a field, into a cow pasture, about 100 or so yards from a farmhouse. And he went over there to check it out, and he saw this creature looking at him standing in the field, and then it scurried away into the woods. I want to make a real quick note here and say that, because I don't think I gave the date, so it's January 20th is the date when everything kind of was seen and started happening. I recently posted a thing on Facebook. I was doing some UFO sighting analysis. And Saturdays are the most common day for UFO sighting reports.
Yeah, didn't John Keel say that? It was like Saturdays and Wednesdays or something.
He said
like
Saturday
that?
And Wednesday, but in actually looking at the new data, it's actually Saturday and Sunday.
I wonder if that's because people are out and about you know,
probably,
and you they're know, they're out more, at night a little bit more.
They're more leisurely out, right? They're not like rushing to somewhere or someplace. Like during the week, you're for the most part, you're like you're on a mission. But January 20, I don't know though that that can hold true everywhere in the world. Like U.S. has been accused a lot of being, you know, very goal focused and goal oriented, and like, you know, just churn. I don't know if the same could be held true for other parts of the world. So to say that, you know, sightings would not be the same or sighting data would be different in other parts of the world, I don't know. Maybe it would, because I'm looking at Newfork data, which is predominantly North America, right?
Yeah, because like Denmark, I mean, they're only 4 days a week, so they would have Friday off.
Right. Well. You know, places like Spain and Portugal, where they take this, you know, like a siesta type period of time during the day, you know, would there be more sightings then? Anyways, bottom line, I would love to get my hands on that data if anybody has it. Anyways,
I'd love to get my hands on a siesta.
Yeah, that'd be good.
I did want to add this in, Josh, a little correlation myself. If you recall, the last time we covered a Brazilian case was Antonio Vias Boas, which was the first alien abduction case in the world that is documented. I looked up where this was. It was about 7 hours and 50 minutes away from each other. So about 8 hours, roughly. So we're still within the same area, basically, you know, a drive across Arizona.
Right. So the reason that's very interesting, very cool. And I'm wondering, look at the date. But the reason I bring up the date now and talking about that research is January 20th, 1996 was a Saturday.
Cool. Yeah. This was October 16th, 1957. I don't know when that was.
Well, hold on. Let me just pull up my handy dandy Microsoft calendar here.
I just pulled it up. It's a Wednesday.
So that meets Keels, right?
Yeah,
so
that meets Keels.
And you know, and I was looking at the last 10 years of data. You know, who know, you know, Keel of course was looking at like 60s, 50s, 60s, 70s data. Mm-hmm. So it may, you know, over a longer period of time, or it may have shifted. So
I just I just know that Brazil is a hot spot for UFOs and aliens and stuff. So, you know, it's interesting that, you know,
well, it's a coastal city, or it's a coastal country, you know. I mean, it's, you know, you look at, I mean, there tends to be there. It's looking more and more likely that, you know, Ivan T. Sanderson wrote a book, Invisible Residents, about sightings that happen in the ocean. We had, you know, Mark D'Antonio on twice, and in both times
he was
on,
baby.
You know, he talked about his, you know, fast mover in the ocean. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, that's probably where most of them are hiding, right, on any given moment. And so any country that has a large oceanic coastline, I think, is going to be more you know, prevalent to see sightings and have things happen. But anyways,
and one day Josh is gonna write a book about it all.
Or I'll just continue to talk about it on this podcast, and somebody else will take my words and write the book about it,
or on your blog, on your Medium.
So, anyways, so he saw it, crash, and like I said, it saw the little, entity that ran off, into the woods. Next thing you kind of know, the military is rolling in. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I mean, when James Fox and his documentary, which is called Virginia, the Roswell of Brazil. When he, in his documentary, they found some people who were alive during this time. You know, it's not that long ago, but they were like young. They were younger kids when it happened, and you know, of course, now they're like older adults and such. But they talked about how quickly the government responded. That like it was in within a couple hours of the first sighting, the government was on site. They were locking down roads. They were doing grid pattern searches, etc. And you know, it's really interesting. It's almost like, you know, there's some sort of centralized training program for militaries around the world to respond to UFO crashes.
Mm-hmm.
you know, to
well, wasn't there somebody that said that in like the manual there is a section on how to deal with UFO crashes or something like that?
Well, so in the military code of and it's not code, the like my dad even talked about in the handbook or whatever that was on like the base where he was, there was a section that talked about what do you do if you see a UFO, but it was small. Mm-hmm. Like, so, and we've talked about that before, really from the mindset of, see, the military never really stopped talking about UFOs. They just stopped publicly talking about UFOs.
Yeah.
But, you know, it really does feel like there is some sort of a, UFO response framework, if you will, that governments around the world are following, because the way that the Brazilian government responded to this case is almost exactly like step by step the way that the U.S. government has been reported as responding to crashes as well. So it's, again, it kind of feels like there's a framework out there somewhere. It's probably not called like UFO response framework or something, but there's a process or a policy that exists that has been made available to militaries around, at least probably with, whoever the allies are.
Right.
Maybe that's a FOIA for the Black Vault folks to figure out and have, go after. Right. Anyway, so military rolled in and they pretty much, they set up roadblocks and, we're really just stopping people as they were coming through. I mean, they're looking for these creatures.
Yeah.
That, what I'm assuming at this point, this is me putting it together based on other accounts that we've heard about, other crashes that we've heard about and talked about, is that they've likely got to the crash scene and found no bodies. So if there were no bodies, they must be somewhere nearby, right? So then they start doing the investigation or the search to try to find them nearby.
Right. No bodies.
Who can? No, I'm not.
See, I can't. Can't not. It's like yeah. Shaving a haircut.
Yeah. It's no. So the there are two entity captures or sightings that occur. The first that we'll talk about is some firemen that were local. People saw a creature that had kind of gone down a steep embankment toward the woods, and boys were throwing stones at it. Because my dad was in town recently and we were out doing the night watch and we were talking about if aliens do ever decide to land on somebody's front yard, they're probably going to get shot. I mean, it's yep. just it's
especially if it's in Arizona or Kentucky.
So they're throwing stones at it trying to get a reaction, which is, when you think about it, that's kind of what we do with laser pointers, right? Hit them with the laser pointer, try to get a reaction, which maybe that's just as offensive to them as throwing stones at them.
Why the invasion's going to happen.
Right, because we all use laser pointers. Yep. That's what it is. So so it goes down this steep embankment. So the firemen are called to go, and they go down the same embankment and they cross a set of railroad tracks and they enter the woods to look for the creature. It says here that Virginia is very hilly with very few level areas. So from where the truck was parked to the closest street to the woods is about 100 meters, which I think if I do my math correct, it's like 300 feet or so. And then dropping, a good 50 meters off of this incline. So the ragged path kind of runs down, and near the bottom is a railroad cutout, and anyone using the path must slip and slide down to the tracks to cross them and then go back up the other side, where the path kind of continues on through the forest. It goes through an old fence, and you enter the woods. And it says here that, you know, it's a very treacherous path, and a lot of people struggle to follow it. It took the firemen 2 hours to capture the creature, partly because it kept running away from them. I mean, obviously, in the dense bushes, and partly because they were afraid of whatever it was. They claimed that it gave off a strong offensive odor. We'll read about the second creature sighting in just a moment, but I want to talk a little bit about this odor. They say it smelled like a strong smell of ammonia.
That's something I've heard before.
Now, I have I find this tangential statement here. Andy Weir, author, you know, wrote The Martian. He wrote a book called Artemis that talks about a colony on the moon. Mm-hmm. And then like 6 months after that book came out, NASA announced that they're going to work on building a colony on the moon. We're going to call it Artemis.
Right.
In his most recent book called Hail Mary, I don't want to give anything away for anybody who hasn't read the book, but there's a section in there where it talks about one of the participants in the book having a strong smell of ammonia. And it's really interesting to me that there's these kind of tangential information that's peeking its head and kind of this is just fiction literature, like, for the masses. It's not, yeah, you know, geared towards paranormal people, but anyways, so thought that was interesting. But I too have heard the other people talk about, yep, the smell of ammonia when things get near. Almost like, you know, makes you wonder if, like, you know, these creatures don't breathe oxygen. Maybe they breathe ammonia.
Yeah. Just because, you know, we go a certain way doesn't mean they do.
Yep. So they finally capture it, and told him that, you know, they asked his commander to come out there and join them, and so they carried it back up this long hill, and the commander had arrived, and as an army truck with two officers and a sergeant, the creature was handed over to the army men with little or no discussion, and everyone left. Hmm. And about this, by the way, was around 8:30 a.m. Is when this is happening on January 20th. So that was 8:30. It took them, let's say, an hour to respond, 2 hours to capture. So, you know, we're looking at like 12:30 or so, 1:30 in the afternoon. Then around 2 o'clock that afternoon, a jogger saw 7 armed soldiers cross a small footbridge from the Santana district into a huge pasture immediately south of the woods. The bridge is at the bottom of a long sloping hill leading up across the pasture to the railroad tracks and higher up the street where the fire truck had parked that morning. 2 of the 7 soldiers appeared to be carrying automatic rifles. All were wearing sidearms. From the footbridge to the street above the woods is at least 600 meters or more. The jogger had intended to take a shortcut across the bridge, but decided not to because of the soldiers. And it says the soldiers walked up the hill and inspected a small grove of trees near the rebel tracks, found nothing, and then moved back towards the big woods, fanning out in a broad V formation. The jogger saw them enter the woods. The witness continued jogging and then turned east into the street, heading towards the Santana district. A minute or two later, the witness heard 3 distinct shots, pow, 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 as if from a rifle, became curious and jogged back 3 or 4 blocks to the street overlooking the woods. By now, an army truck was parked there, about where the fire truck had been earlier, and the witness could see 4 of the soldiers struggling up the long steep bank with 2 bags, 2 soldiers to each bag.
Jeez.
1 bag was squirming as if something live was in it, but the other had no movement. Yeah. Other soldiers Yeah. Other soldiers were inside the truck. The bags were heaved into the truck and the truck sped away. Neither the witness nor the investigators know what was in the bags. So
I do.
Yeah. I mean, it is possible they captured, you know, a wild animal, a dog or something. Who knows? I mean,
but, skinwalker.
Yeah. At around dusk that afternoon, so around 6 p.m. or so, a short but violent hailstorm, and it says that this is quite unusual for that time of the year, hit Virginia. It broke windows, windshields, and caused other damage. And it wiped out any prints or traces of the creature the three young women had seen. So this is, now I want to talk about what the three young women had seen.
Yeah, this is the Silva sisters.
Yep, this is the Silva sisters. And so they were headed, just kind of walking, and they decided to cut through this open lot. And as they're cutting through this open lot, the one up, well, I don't think they're all sisters. I think two are sisters and one is a friend or a cousin. But anyways, they're cutting through the open lot, and they see this creature squatted down, like huddled against the wall of this open lot. And it's when you hear open lot, you know, depending on where you live in the world, you may have a different picture. But it's actually, it's really a walled in area, right? There's a doorway gate that goes into it. There's a doorway gate that goes out of it on the other side. It's surrounded by buildings, so it's kind of walled in. But you know, inside of it is just, you know, dirt and grass and flowers and everything else. So it's basically a lot that was probably intended to be built on and never was. So they're walking through this lot, though, and against one of the walls is this creature that's huddled against the wall. They describe it as having kind of like brown, oily skin. It was trembling. Like it was cold. It had big red eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And what appeared to be little horns on top of its head.
Yeah, and they had V-shaped feet. Like, this is a very famous image. There's even a statue of their description of it in Virginia as well.
Yeah, so the feet were really interesting because so, you know, they saw this. They freaked out and they ran away. They ran to their parents' house, and they told their mom, "You have, you know, what's going on." And so she went with them to investigate as well. And she reported seeing not the creature, but she saw footprints in the kind of mud in this area. And she described them as being, you know, that three-toed, footprint. And so this is where, you know, I want to talk about, you know, the correlation here between this case and like the Hopkinsville, Kentucky case, because mm-hmm. they were also dealing with about the same size with large eyes and the three-toed footprint, as well as the Hellyer case.
Yep.
From the Hellyer documentary. They talked about it and even received a photo back of this footprint that was a three-toed footprint. So it's, you know, some really strong correlation there between really different parts of the world. But again, you know, if you look at these places on a map, you know, they tend to kind of fall in line with each other.
Yeah.
It, you know, really makes you wonder about, you know, again, the kind of subterranean aspects of the earth and what we do and don't know.
So. Well, and you know, the girls and the mother smelled the ammonia as well. But the other thing I was going to say is, you know, the girls screamed, "No, we didn't see an alien, but we saw the devil."
Right.
So again, talking about how culture and religion can shape
what
we think we see, like the fairies of old and devils of old and things like that. Here's another case of we saw the devil.
Now, there's another, and I'm going to pull this from me seeing the documentary from James Fox, because there's another account that in all the articles that I read online, I could not find. And that is, one of the so some soldiers were driving around the streets of Virginia in a Jeep, and they spot the creature dart across the road. So one of them jumps out, grabs the creature with his hands, and wrangles him into the Jeep, and they go to the local hospital to like do x-rays or something, like, you know, to take x-rays or something of this creature to see what they're working with. That soldier who grabbed the creature later that day develops an illness that doctors cannot explain, and mm-hmm. he dies within 24 hours.
Yeah, I was actually going to say one of the things that I researched and found was that another close encounter was from a janitor of a zoo. He was a zoo janitor, and the animals that he worked with, that he cleaned their stalls and things like that, like after his close encounter, within a few months died. Hmm. And they think that maybe it was radiation or something from his close encounter. At least that's what he thinks.
Well, and apparently, like, a lot of the trees that were around the crash died off. Like, they were, like, you know, young, healthy trees, mm-hmm. and they all died off from whatever was in the area. So, I mean, it just, you know, it really makes you wonder, or not wonder, but it makes you think, be careful what you ask for, right? Yeah. There are a lot of people who want to have a close encounter, you know, that want to see a craft up close.
Yeah.
But you're dealing with, you know, potentially science and elements that we don't really understand, yeah. right, as a people. And so, I mean, this is a very strong case where, you know, at no point in time in any of the accounts did the creatures seem hostile. There's never an account of them attacking anyone. You know, the three girls in the lot, that creature could have leapt out and attacked them, mm-hmm. but it didn't. It stayed, you know, kind of huddled against the side of the wall.
Yep.
So nothing about this says this was an attack. But getting sick and dying, or, you know, or having an illness in you know, from encountering the creatures, is still possible. And so, you know, the thing I think the big to draw the difference here is that, you know, if you go and eat a rock and you have like bad digestive system issues,
like Rock Biter from the Never Ending Story,
right. You know, well, he's made to eat rocks. I'm talking you, like your fleshy body, you yeah. decide, or like you swallow 13 nails or something. And
or
then
dogs,
next thing you know,
dogs will do it, man. They'll eat yeah. rocks sometimes, and they got to either push it through or get surgery.
My point is that the rock did not attack you just yeah. because you decided to put yourself in that situation to now be harmed.
What you're saying.
So, you know, it's just. Yeah, and I think that's probably true for a lot of ET or alien or whatever you want to say, or UFO crash experiencers, is if you get sick from the experience, it's just an adverse reaction to your body not being able to handle whatever the physical circumstances were yeah. of that experience, but don't necessarily classify that as an attack.
Right. So.
Anyways, so let's I'm gonna jump real quick to talk a little bit more about James Fox's documentary, because he worked on this thing for 10 years.
This is called Moment of Contact, right?
Yes. Yep. You're right. It is called Moment of Contact. Earlier I said Virginia, the Roswell, Brazil, but it is. I think that's like the sub, whatever. It's,
yeah, sub-line. The subtitle.
Yeah. But yeah, Moment of Contact is the name of the documentary. And of course, you know, he wrote, like, you know, he did Out of the Blue, I Know What You Saw, The Phenomenon, which I think got a lot of
one of my favorites,
you know, because of when it came out in relation to the U.S. government report and et cetera. But so he spent 10 years working on, you know, not full 10 years, but, you know, off and on over 10 years working on this case, and then finally decided, you know, now's the time to go and do this full investigation. And so when he went down to Brazil, the doc, number one, the documentary, like he does, it's very well done. I mean, it's a fantastic documentary. Like I said, I got a chance to see it with others at the UFO Congress before anybody else had seen it. And it's funny, they started playing it, and for some reason the video was like clipping, you know, like it was like maybe they were trying to stream it and the internet mm-hmm. connection was not great. And so it had played for like 5 or 6 minutes, and next he like comes out from behind the curtain and he's like, you know what? Nope, stop it. This is the first time I'm seeing it too, and I'm not gonna watch it when it's clipping like this. And so they spent a little bit of time fixing it so that it would not clip, and then we watched the whole thing. And then afterwards he took, you know, some kind of questions and gave some information and allowed people in the Congress to ask questions and stuff. It was a really cool opportunity. But one of the things that he talked about is the main investigator that kind of did all the investigation at the time that it happened. You know, he had passed on. But in the documentary, they had his daughter provide a lot of, you know, kind of his state of mind and things. And I find it interesting. His daughter is a psychologist.
Ah, that's awesome.
And so, you know, of all the people to be skeptical and potentially say, you know, this is just all in your mind, or, you know, it's metaphor or something like that, she would be it. But no, she was, you know, remembered her father's state of being, and you know, had the documentary actually shows some video footage and pictures that have never before been seen, because she had access to them being his daughter. So I highly recommend, if you haven't already, to watch the documentary of the case, because it is very good. And honestly,
yeah, I haven't seen it yet, so I'm very excited to see it.
I mean, it's probably, along with The Phenomenon, one of his best documentaries, in my opinion, that he's done. One of the things, and I forgot to mention this when I was covering the details of the case, there was this, actually, this case involves some Men in Black sightings as well. So the mother of the three girls that had their sighting, she says that later, that evening, after she had, you know, kind of giving her statement to everything, three men dressed in all black suits came and knocked on her door, and she had kind of invited them into the little ante room, you know, before you go into the rest of the house. Mm-hmm. I think it's called an ante room, but anyways,
yeah, I know what you mean.
And they basically offered her thousands of dollars to recant and forget about this whole thing. And she said, you know, no, because, you know, that would have like mental impact on my daughters to say, you know, I don't believe you, or no one believes you, you know, to basically go down that road. And so she refused, and they basically threatened her in a non-direct way, and then they left. And she said they got into a big black sedan that had no license plate on it. That sounds exactly like, you know, some of Keel's accounts of the Men in Black, you know, that right. They would be in like these big dark sedans or whatever. The guy who was the only eyewitness to the crash, he's interviewed in the documentary. They found that he came back and they interviewed him. He was approached the same way. He said he was sitting at a table in like a cafe, and three men walked up and said, "You're just going to disappear."
Ugh.
And so he said he had no ties to the area. You know, he didn't have wife and kids, so he left. He took their money and he left, and he disappeared for 30 years.
Wow.
So, yeah, you know, Men in Black, alien humanoids, crash. And what's really, I think, the most amazing thing of all of this is that it happened in a time where our technology allowed us to capture things that we didn't have in 1947 for the Roswell crash.
Right.
you know, so like I said, there are, when you watch the documentary, there's some video that was shown, there's some pictures that were captured for the sighting that happened out over the water. The fisherman I talked about in the beginning that took some pictures out over the water, that's shown in the documentary. Yeah, it's just, it's an amazing case. And like you said, there is a lot of this, along with the Antonio Villas-Boas case, and I'm sure there are others that have yet to be investigated for the area. And it just really really makes you wonder, like you said, around the kind of cultural, societal norm around calling things the demon or the devil or whatever. How many other, you know, devil sightings have there been in the world that kind of go unnoticed or unmentioned? And that's one of the things that, you know, we do right as we start to look at these convergences is don't look for UFO sightings, look for fairy sightings, look for light in the sky sightings, look for all different types of things, look for devil sightings, look for demon sightings, and try to apply those cultural labels that people use and what you're looking for to see if there are related cases that are out there that have kind of flown under the radar and not been picked up because they don't involve the word UFO or alien or extraterrestrial or Bigfoot. So
yeah. So I put up a little picture of what they thought it was to see there. I did want to give the skeptical viewpoint, so might as well do it out there. In regards to the creature, there was an official inquiry led by the Brazilian military authority. So, you know, I don't know how much we can trust that. But they concluded that the Silver Sisters had actually come across a homeless, mentally unstable man nicknamed Mudinho, which means covered in mud. So they think that it was just a homeless man covered in mud. I don't know how that explains red eyes or horns or V-shaped feet or anything like that. Just the brown skin.
And also, I mean, the smell of ammonia would was he like taking an ammonia bath every morning?
Right.
When he got, well, and then also they did describe him as being like 3 to 3.5 feet tall. I mean, I know there's some short people in the world. But
right. Well, the military also stated the aliens seen there were someone who had dwarfism. So they said that a citizen known as Mudinho, who probably had some mental disability and whose physical characteristics match the description, make it likely that the hypothesis that the citizen probably being dirty due to the heavy rains and seen crouching by a wall was mistaken by the three terrified girls as a space creature.
So how do they explain the military guy that picked one up and then died?
Oh, I know. I mean, or
holes.
The
holes everywhere.
Or the janitor at the zoo, the first guy who saw it run off into the woods. I mean, you know.
Yeah, there's more holes in that cover story than Swiss cheese. So, but anyways, bottom line, if it's not been clear, I recommend you watch the documentary and make it so. Do it now.
Yep.
Watch it.
Check it out. Moment of Contact, the Roswell. Brazilian Roswell case.
You can rent it on Amazon Prime, or you can buy it on Prime, but I don't think it's available really anywhere else right now
at the moment.
Yeah,
cool. Well, thanks, Josh. I appreciate that, man. Again, we will be back in 2 weeks with our season finale with Dr. Lynn Katai. It's going to be an absolutely fun, and then it's going to be a few months, so make sure you guys are joining the Proveniens Obscura Society at patreon.com/ the Sea Enigma, so you can figure out what's going on and you can help join us in the research. But we got to get out of here, Josh. Make sure to go to fearscapemedia.com for all of our other shows and theconvergenceenigma.com to see what's going on with us. Other than that, Josh, this has been Stefan. Keep your eyes on the skies.
This has been Josh. The truth is now.
And remember, folks, hold those blankets extra tight because things tend to get spooky when you're listening to the Convergence Enigma. No, really, seriously. Just remember, keep questioning, keep searching. All right, guys? Never give up, never surrender. Good night, everybody.
Good night.